Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Enthusiasticast, the weekly web show where we always recommend an awesome book. He's Mark, I'm John, and this week I'm going to be enthusiastic about Joshua Ferris's sophomore novel, The Unnamed. But before we get to that, Mark, last week the MOBY Awards were handed out for the best and the worst in book trailers. So I wanted to get your thoughts on what you thought were the best book trailers and what you think about book trailers in general. Are they meaningful or is it just dancing about architecture? And given limited budgets and other resources, do the chances of turning off your audience with a bad trailer outweigh the potential benefits?
So what do I think about book trailers is really the question?
What do you think about book trailers? Good idea, bad idea, sometimes good, sometimes bad?
Okay, so I'm stoked about book trailers, to be honest. So I think they're great. And I've had both experiences that you kind of outline or allude to in your question, right? I've, like, been excited about book trailers, and I've also been like, I'm not going anywhere near that book because of a book trailer, right? So I just think that it comes down to the fact, well, forget the movie analogy, like, they aren't trailers. They're commercials. They're cheap commercials. The price of production has come down. They're ads. If they're treated as ads, they're great. If they're treated as you know, we need to, like, pump up the plot and hire actors that can't show their faces to walk down hallways and stuff like that, as, like, overwrought language is read over top, as a proxy for the drama that you see in a movie trailer, disaster.
Yes.
But, you know, I think there's tons of potential for book ads, right? Like, you know, we're talking about an industry that doesn't know how to advertise, essentially. Like, have you read the jacket copy of a book out there? You know, like, it's more often than not just, like, expresses the collective anxiety or insecurity of the editorial division at a publisher, right? It's got like all of the plug quotes. It doesn't say anything about what the book is about. Doesn't say anything why you'd want to read it. It's just like the weirdest, brutalist. Anyway, so publishers, I think, don't get advertising in general, right? Both out of home and on book jackets, and book trailers in a way are just a further extension of that kind of schizophrenia about advertising. But I think when done well, and, like, there's lots of potential there. I'm really excited for them. I sense that you're on the more cynical side of the spectrum here.
Well, I think you put it very well, actually. And I think that misnomer of calling them book trailers has actually led a lot of people down the wrong path. As with so much of anything, I see more being done wrong than being done right, although there are some book trailers that I really, really liked. You know, from this year and from the trailers that they had selected for these MOBY Awards, I think, I'll do them in reverse order. I thought the one for Wild Child, T.C. Boyle's Wild Child, was very good. It made me want to read that book. That was basically my criteria for whether or not I thought it was good, right? It made me want to read that. I thought the one for Jonathan Safran Foer's Tree of Codes was really interesting because if I didn't already know what the conceit of that book was, it was intriguing enough to make me want to go and find out. So that was a nice teaser ad. And I think my two favorites, though, were Where Good Ideas Come From, the Steven Johnson book, which was fantastic. It's this kind of whiteboard animation which takes you through the ideas behind the book, and it was just fascinating in its own right, and then it really made me want to read the book. And then, discongruously, Little Chicken's Big Day by Katie Davis. I don't know if you watched this trailer.
I didn't see that one. What?
It was like in the children's section, right? And it was fantastic because if I was a parent of very young children, my kids are a bit older, and I was looking for, you know, this is the kind of thing you're going to respond to because it's completely adorable. It tells you what it is, and it tells you what you can expect from the book. But just going through this whole great glut of these things, there was just so many things which to me seemed obvious that were done wrong, right? There were the trailers that didn't tell you up front that it was a book. So you could literally be watching this whole trailer and not know, A, that it was an ad, and B, what it was an ad for, right? So my favorites always, right up at the front, would say, you know, just the title of the book, the author, when it was going to be in stores. Just really, really basic stuff. That whole trailer thing where they would try to be a trailer for a movie that didn't exist. And, you know, you combine that with book trailers that didn't tell you it was for a book. So you could actually watch 95% of the trailer thinking, wow, this is a trailer for a really bad film. And then find out, oh, wait, it's not even a film. It's a fake bad film that is meant to give me the plot of a book that may or may not be good. But to judge by the quality of this, it's not, which is really unfair because it was probably made, you know, shoestring budget with non-professional actors and production people and, you know, what have you. So it's doing a disservice to its product. And then ultimately, because you're looking at, you know, web-based video, it's kind of got to have the qualities of viral video, right? It has to be interesting slash funny slash clever enough that people are going to, you know, note it and send it around. And at the same time, it still has to do the job of giving me a reason to read the book, not necessarily recapping the plot, although that can be, you know, that can be one way, but generally, you know, leaving me knowing what the product is and wanting to find out more and wanting to look for it. So, like I say, I think the two best were Where Good Ideas Come From, which was fantastic, and I think everybody should go and watch it, and Little Chicken's Big Day. I'm not going to go and pick up Little Chicken's Big Day because I don't have an audience for it, but if I was in the market for that kind of thing, that did a great job of selling what they were selling.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So like my thing is like advertise, don't dramatize. And that Steven Johnson one is like, it's almost an excerpt, right? Like yes. it's like the big ideas of the book, like condensed into 2 minutes. It's brilliant. So,
and it's got high production values. And so it's the kind of thing where, because there's so much quality in the book trailer, that reflects. It's like dressing well for a job interview, right? I don't understand these trailers that go out there that look cheap and poorly done. You just stay home. Save your money.
Right. Right. And, well, we both know why that those trailers come about the way that they do.
I understand the reasons why. I'm just a sober second thought, folks.
Yeah. So in unrelated book news, mere moments ago, before I got on the phone with you here, I opened my web browser and I see that Tom Cruise is going to star as Jack Reacher. Did you see this news?
No.
It hit EW.com like about 3 hours ago. And so he has signed up to do One Shot, which was the 2005... Lee Child novel, and yeah, Lee Child has come out and endorsed the Cruiser as a possible character, or as a possible actor, and there's a director assigned, and the whole thing. It looks like it's going to happen.
I'm not even anti Tom Cruise, honestly. Tom Cruise is one of those guys where I don't have any personal warm feeling towards him as a personality or as an actor. But when I look back over his filmography, I'm just like, wow, there's a lot of movies in there that I was really entertained by. So I don't specifically have a problem with him as an actor. I just feel like he's doing his best stuff now by playing against type. And this is, Reacher is kind of a version of his action hero persona, which I don't think works for him anymore. So I don't know what he has to bring to this. But you know what? They'll make it. I'll see it. I'll judge it then.
Huh. So
I could be more thrilled though by a different choice. Do I think he's going to do a good job? If I was a betting man, I would not bet on that. No.
Well, it becomes a Tom Cruise movie, right? So then you judge it by Tom Cruise standards, right?
Exactly.
Like, you know, when I think of Reacher, I think of kind of like slovenly shopping at Walmart kind of thing. And you know, I don't think, you know, Cruz doesn't shop at Walmart. He's too cocky.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, a younger Liam Neeson could do Reacher.
Well, that's interesting. So my first choice would be Daniel Craig, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like if you were to go A-list and maybe Josh Brolin?
Yes.
But if you were to like do the young Liam Neeson, then I would pick that guy that did the twins in The Social Network.
Right. Yeah, Arnie Hamner, is that his name?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I like Josh Brolin though.
Right.
I think that's a great pick.
Like,
but now it'll never happen. So.
Spoken on the internet will never happen. Okay, and then the other. This is totally off topic, but we're. Otherwise, just going to talk about this stuff after the show, and then I'll be tempted to like put it in as after credits, so we might as well just get it out of the way now. The New York Times story about the DC Universe reset. Like, is this news, or is this just one of those cases where the New York Times like latches onto a story that's, you know, 3 months old?
No, this is massive news. It was all the news of the comics internet last week, but I don't think that we want to have a 2-minute conversation about it, considering that the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast just did 3 hours on it.
The Fuzzy Typewriter podcast?
Yeah, Paul Montgomery. He's wicked. I don't know about the podcast. Actually, I've read his stuff on the internet, but I haven't listened to his show. But I know that they just posted today a 3-hour-plus show about the DC Universe reboot, and it's massive. The Coles notes for the viewers out there, and the reason why it's kind of important is it plays into the whole narrative about the rise of the ebook. Comics are tied into a very archaic distribution system, the direct market comic specialty stores, and that ties them to physical media. So they've been very, very Johnny-come-lately in terms of making digital comics available. So not only is DC Comics rebooting their entire line, so there will be 52 new number one comics that you can just pick up and read without having ever read a DC comic book before in your life come September. But all of those comics will be available online through the DC Comics app, day and date. They will match the physical media price on the day of release. And then I believe a month later, the price will drop by a dollar.
Huh. Okay. So it's also relevant because like 3 episodes ago, you gave me kind of the primer on the DC Universe.
Yes.
Which is now carte blanche.
I mean, a lot of the same stuff is, you know, of the 52 titles, 11 of them feature Batman or related characters. So, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I think Superman has a collar on his outfit now. So
we're going to talk about Joshua Ferris.
Now, yes, we are.
Joshua Ferris is someone that you recommended, I don't know, you probably know the episode number, way back in the day. You sold me on your recommendation. I'm like, sign me up, sign me up. You lent me the book, and then nothing, and then I never read it.
Did I, though? I think you're remembering it wrong. A, there's no episode number because it was one of the first shows that we recorded that we never posted because it wasn't good enough. And B, I think I spectacularly failed to sell you on Joshua Ferris's first novel. Then we came to the end.
Okay.
So this is my chance for redemption.
That's a murky kickoff point. I don't know if you can rescue the conversation from that, but tell me why you're enthusiastic, sir.
Okay, so Joshua Ferris, relatively young guy. He was one of the New Yorker's 20 under 40. And his first book, called Then We Came to the End, was a finalist for the National Book Award, and it won the Penn Hemingway Award in 2007. And I read it, and I really, really liked it. It's kind of a comedic novel. It's a satire about the workplace. It's set in the sort of dot-com bust of the early 2000s at an ad agency in Chicago where the hammer's falling and there's been rounds of layoffs. And the literary trick of it was that it was written in first person plural. So it's not one character telling the story. It's the we of the employees telling this story. And I just thought it was really clever and insightful and very funny. But underneath that, it also had a real sort of core of human emotion. And in fact, there was a few places where it would flip out of the first person plural. And one of those places was a long section dealing with the office supervisor who had breast cancer and was going in to have surgery, and just a really wonderful piece of character writing there that added, I thought, a lot of weight to everything else that was going on in the book and was varying degrees of facetious or clever or snarky or what have you. At the time, I think I said it was just sort of Douglas Copeland with less brand names and better sincerity. I like Douglas Copeland, so it was right up my alley. And after I read it, I came to it a little bit late. It was like late 2008, early 2009 when I read it, and he was just about to release The Unnamed, which was his follow-up novel. So that came out. I couldn't get to it right away, and then some reviews rolled in, and they were lukewarm to negative, honestly. I didn't read a lot of them, but I just read enough to go, ooh, sophomore slump, and I'm kind of a believer in the sophomore slump, right? I think you have a lot to bring to your first novel, and then it's like, what do you do for an encore? So I almost wasn't surprised by that, and I stayed away from it a little bit. Then months later, I'm listening to the Slate, not even the Culture Gab Fest, the Political Gab Fest, and it was David Plotz, who's like the editor-in-chief of Slate, and they have a little bit at the end where they talk about whatever they're into that week, and he talked about The Unnamed and how much he was really digging it and really enjoying it, and I was like, well, that's one. Maybe I should revisit this. You know, maybe I just wasn't in sync with those reviewers who were not blown away by it. And so I finally got around to reading it, and I go in expecting something different and maybe something not as good as then we came to the end. And it's definitely different. It is, in a lot of ways, a real departure from Then We Came to the End. Then We Came to the End is funny. The Unnamed, not funny, or at least not comedic. Then We Came to the End is satirical. This is far more philosophical. Then We Came to the End is this first-person plural trick. The Unnamed is much more traditional in that it's just a third-person plural. And I got to say, though, I really enjoyed it. I feel like it's a Your Mileage May Vary book. I feel like it's probably not going to be for everyone, and hopefully people will be able to figure out from what I'm saying about it whether or not it might be for them. But just to give you the bare bones, the plot of the book, there's the main character. His name is Tim Farnsworth. And he's married. His wife is Jane. They've got a teenage daughter, Becca. And his deal is he's a successful New York lawyer. In fact, he's a partner in his firm. So he's kind of one of these uber successful, uber wealthy New York lawyers. And his problem is, however, that he walks uncontrollably. So I don't know if you've read anything about this that you would know what the setup is, but basically, you know, he'll be in a meeting with a client and he'll just get up and walk out and he has no control of it. And his body just walks and walks and walks and walks and walks and walks from like Manhattan to New Jersey. And until basically whatever odd compulsion is making him walk burns itself out and gives up. And then he just collapses wherever he is from exhaustion and will wake up, you know, tucked in a booth at a KFC or a parking lot or wherever. And call his wife, you know, his long-suffering wife, who will come and get him. And so at the start of the novel, he is having his first recurrence. So this is like a problem that happened in the past, and they dealt with it, and it went away, and he was able to rebuild his life. And now it's come back, and they're sort of staring down the barrel at that. And so the opening part of the novel is all how he's dealing with this. And, you know, it gets into all of the sort of the practical concerns of, he's not necessarily dressed for the elements whenever this compulsion takes him to go walking. So he carries a backpack with him wherever he goes. It has like, you know, gloves and a scarf and a, you know, a shell and some walking boots and all this stuff with him so that he can dress himself as he walks, depending on, you know, what's going on outside. He gets like frostbite in his fingers and toes and all of this sort of thing. And honestly, it gets off to such clip of plot and exposition at the beginning that I was really wondering where it was going to go. A lot of the first act I found to be stuff that I would have expected more in the second act in terms of the way it complicates its life, his life, and, you know, the kinds of emotional and professional issues that it brings up. And then it just keeps going. And it, I feel like there's a real potential in it, though, to set up expectations in the reader of where it's going to go, of things that are going to be important. And then those things aren't going to play out the way people expect, or they're not even going to play out at all. And that could be a frustration for some readers. I just went with it, and it was the kind of book that I never really wanted to put down. I was always excited to get back to it. I was always excited to see what happens next, because it went to a lot of places that I wasn't expecting. At the same time, it has the structure kind of mirrors his walks, and I don't know if it's in an intentional or unintentional way, but it has this. So he'll go for, you know, these long walks and then come back from them, come back to the home at the beginning at least. But he's always going for longer and longer walks, more and more frequently. And the book is kind of like that. It goes further and further afield, and then it'll swing back on itself a little bit and sort of, you know, touch base to some of the core emotions or the core themes. And so if I had to compare it to some things, it really reminded me, and these are bad comparisons if you want to talk about plot, but there were elements of The Time Traveler's Wife, and I know you haven't read that, but you're familiar with it, obviously, and very much in the sense that there's no name. The unnamed of the title is his affliction. There's no name for his affliction. There's no diagnosis. And so the first part of the book deals with his past quests and his future endeavors, trying to find out what is wrong with him so that he can fix it. And that doesn't go well. And so it deals with that frustration, you know, and the kind of fear that that has for a person, especially in this day of, you know, the diagnosis of a name for everything. And then the other thing that it made me, it really recalled a lot, especially in the later parts of the book, is, and this is a big comparison, but is Cormac McCarthy's The Road, in terms of his traveling. And the landscape as he moves through it, and it, the way he relates to it, the way we relate to our bodies and the way our bodies relate to the world is a big part of the book. And although it's not an apocalyptic novel in the sense of, you know, the world ending, it is his world ending. And so that feeling of apocalypse is in a lot of the later parts of the book. And so it's just got all of this wonderful stuff about human relationships and what are the foundations of loyalty and how loyalty bends and how loyalty breaks and how the spirit bends and how the spirit breaks and what is meaningful in our lives. And in that sense, it's kind of a continuation from Then We Came to the End, because Then We Came to the End is about the way the disruption or the potential disruption of their working life affects the people in this office. And it does it in a very light, comedic way. But at the same time, you know, it kind of points up how work, even work that in itself is kind of meaningless, can be really meaningful in your life and what happens when that's threatened. And then this book shows a guy whose work is pretty much, is very meaningful. He's very satisfied in his work. He loves his work. And I mean, the first thing that takes the biggest hit is his work, because he'll walk out of trials. He'll walk out of client meetings. You know, he tells lies to cover up his condition. And so, you know, it all goes pear-shaped. And then it just keeps on exploding, everything that, every construct that he has that's meaningful to him. And so it takes some of those earlier themes and, you know, goes to a very extreme place with them. And I just feel like, I just finished the book today, but I feel like it's not a perfect book by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel like in the same way that you said that the most recent William Gibson novel was a book that you weren't 100% on at first, but that you kept coming back to in your mind over and over and over again after you read it. I know that this is a book that I'm going to be thinking about a long time from now, and that there's probably scenes that will always stay with me. So on that basis alone, I have to give it the reco.
So it sounds like it's a stunt, right? Like it sounds like
it does.
And it likely is, right? Like, but does it come across as a cheap one?
No, he totally commits to it. And that was my big anxiety, my big question going into it is like, okay, I get the stunt, but how do you sustain this for 300 pages? You know, how do you turn this into a plot? And it gives some hints of where that's going to go. And then it doesn't go to those places and it goes to other places. There's, I guess you would call it, you know, trickery. There's some stunts that he pulls in the nature of the narrative. He plays some games with time. He plays some games with perception. But I understand why he did it, and I like the results that he got out of doing those things. They propelled the narrative along. They made it more interesting, and they kept the pace. It's really surprisingly, you know, given that, you know, when you compare this to a more action-y story, or you know, a story with, you know, more emotional fireworks, it's kind of sedate. I found it very propulsive to read.
So I don't know if you can answer this question without going to spoilers or whatever, but like, what's he trying to say? Like, what's the thing with the walking, right? Like, what is it? I'm sure it's not a very linear, clear-cut metaphor, but like, what's he getting at?
I feel like that's the kind of thing I'm going to be turning over for a while. If I had to say right now,
like, he chose walking for a reason, right? So it's just like, that's an interesting choice for an affliction.
Well, it's actually fantastic in a lot of ways, right? It had to be something that was completely out there, right? That didn't really map to any other affliction, right? So it serves that purpose, and so it handles the fear of the unknowable and the unanswerable, and also, you know, walking itself is just a great, it's traveling, right? It's traveling through the world, so it's a great metaphor, because that's what he's just talking about, the way we live our lives, and you know, that's just traveling through the world. So it's a, you know, it's a nice, obvious metaphor in that way. But then it gets down to the physicality of walking, and, you know, walking puts him directly in conflict, puts his human biology directly in conflict with nature. And so then it becomes about, you know, mortality and the fact that the universe is at all times not trying to kill you, but going to kill you and not caring particularly when it kills you. And how do you deal with that? Right. And how do you deal with that when all of the artificial and somewhat flimsy structures that you've constructed to help you deal with that go away? And what is left that still has meaning? And is it what you would think has meaning? Is it the, you know, is it the Hallmark card stuff, right? About, you know, everything that means something in life is free, or whatever. And it touches all of the bases, right? It really, I felt it was fairly thorough, and it really went around on that. And I don't want to say too much because, I mean, this is the meat of the book. But I liked the ideas that it caused me to have in my head about my life.
Oh, that's perfect. So it's just that, you know, it's like, okay, so I never would have thought that that's what the book was about based on the outside, right? Like,
it's a nice blue cover.
The unnamed says nothing, right? And the cover and the jacket treatment say very little. And then normally when you pull a stunt like that off, you get, you know, New York Times attention or whatever. You get like marquee attention by people pointing and saying, hey, neat trick, dude, or whatever, right? because those tend to be easy books to review and talk about. And I heard nothing about this.
And I don't think the stunt is going to work for everyone. Just going on to Goodreads. It maybe worked about 50% of the time. So, you know, big caveat going into this one, it worked for me, but I can totally see if some things rub you the wrong way that you wouldn't want to go with it. And then...
Would the criticisms that it was a little too... it was a little too, Forrest Gump?
Yeah, I mean, I heard Forrest Gump a lot, and that's kind of superficial. I feel that there's a few plot elements that are introduced very early on. One of the cases that he's working on at the law firm is a murder case. And then on one of the very early walks that you're shown, there's a guy who sort of accosts him or comes up to talk to him and basically claims to be the real killer. He's representing the guy who's been accused of the crime. This other guy is saying, no, it was me. But because he's walking, he's like in the grip of one of his walks, he can't stop. He can't like talk to the guy. He can't grab the guy. He can't stick a cop on the guy. He walks away from him, right? And so there's almost this Scott Turow-esque feeling that, oh, it's going to be a murder mystery or a courtroom drama or whatever. And it's totally not, you know? And then there's this sense, again, based on the early parts with his wife, his daughter, she's a disaffected teen. Their relationship is not the best, the main character and his daughter, Tim and Becca. And, you're like, oh, is it going to be about how, is it going to be that kind of story where the big city lawyer learns to, put aside material things and spend time with his family for the simple pleasures of hearth and home? And it's not really that either, right? So I feel like, you could get disappointed in this book very easily. And then having read the whole thing and looking back on it, I actually like the way those sort of little false trails play into the whole book. And I do feel like there's meaning to them and import to them. But, if you didn't know or you weren't willing to go with it, it could go wrong for you. Absolutely. And also to go back to then we came to the end, I should say, it's a satire about people losing their jobs in a bad economy. I read this book. I was employed when I read it. I had been employed for a long time. I'm still employed. So, and again, it's looking back at the .com bubble burst of the early 2000s. It came out just as we were heading into the big crash. And so that's another one. I think that one under normal circumstances is a more clear win than The Unnamed. I think that that's going to, and it obviously did. It won some big prizes. It won almost universal praise. I think that one is going to be a surefire hit for more people under normal circumstances. But obviously, given the economy right now, these aren't normal circumstances. So if the economy is really poking you in the eye right now, that might not be a fun book to sit down with. I'm just saying.
Cool. Good pick. That's like kind of a Mark recommendation, actually, which is kind of nice.
Yeah, well, it had been genre for a while, and I have read a couple of – it might be literary for me for the next little bit. We'll see.
Okay. So I guess we'll call it there. That's it for today. We're at enthusiasticast.com. You can check us out there. That would also be the place that you can tell us that we're full of crap or tell us that you really enjoy the show or whatever. If you want to disagree with us, please do it there. And I guess if you feel like spreading the word on Twitter, you could do that using a hashtag or two. We're at EnthusiasticCast. Whichever the case, I guess, I hope you enjoyed listening. And until next time, I'm Mark.
And I'm John.
Cheers.